Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Got my co-host here, Dr. Carl. And we are going to talk over some cases today. We don't have a special guest today. This is going to be a quick podcast to go over a couple cases. Like, what would we do in certain cases where we see someone come into the clinic, or in my case, online clinic, to see me? So we picked out a few cases here.
And yeah, and these are based on really almost like the topics of request recently. So yeah. I'm not going to like give it away per se, but we're also not trying to pimp our colleagues in academics, since this is for people. But these are a couple cases of common disease states that we certainly see a lot of and take care of that people just wanted us to talk more about.
Yeah. All right. So what's the first one?
All right. So this is actually based upon a case I just presented for an academic conference up north for endocrinologists. That doesn't really give you a hint since we do almost all of that stuff. But I'll try to change it up so it sounds more appropriate for the people out there. So this is a 59-year-old African-American guy. He's been struggling with obesity for a long time. He has type 2 diabetes. He has kidney disease. He actually has coronary disease. He had a non-ST elevation heart attack, MI, a couple of years ago. And he's concerned because his primary care, I'm going to say it's you since you're the family practice doc, said that his liver enzymes were elevated. So you got this guy. He's struggling with weight. He's got diabetes. He's got heart disease, some kidney disease. And he got his annual labs done, something called the hemoglobin A1C that I think we've talked about that correlates to an average blood sugar is 7.5%.
Three months average blood sugar, 7.5%.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's like his blood sugar's average in the high hundreds. I'd have to.
That's fine.
And, but then also when he's getting his kidneys checked and everything, his AST, these are, we call them aminotransferases, they're liver enzymes. AST is 40 and his ALT is 80. What do you think of that, Dr. Spencer? Family practice, well, you got these things. You got to see
him. Is he on any medicines? What's going on?
He is on. He's on rosuvastatin, a statin to lower his cholesterol, to reduce his cardiovascular risk.
How much? How many milligrams?
How many do you think?
He better be on 20.
No, he's on 40. He's
all right,
forward.
At least, all right,
good. All right, he takes an aspirin. I'm going to actually change this up because some of what I was trying to get people at my conference to talk about was what medications are appropriate for kidney disease and coronary disease. So I'm going to say he's on metformin. He's on one of our favorite GLPs, semaglutide.
Oh, nice.
He's on something called lisinopril, which is an ACE inhibitor for his blood pressure and his kidneys and his heart. And we'll also say he's on empagliflozin or Jardiance. So for those of you out there, he's on Ozempic, that weekly shot that mimics your intestine hormones to help you lose weight, improve your sugars, and has heart benefits. And empagliflozin is called Jardiance. And these are the medications that trick your kidneys into peeing out sugar. And they're really good for your kidneys and heart.
Well,
but he's got this elevated
nutrition.
What's it?
Who's
doing his nutrition stuff? he doesn't drink any sugary drinks. He goes out to eat a couple times a week. He's trying to go a little bit low carb, but it's really hard for him. He struggles. He has, he stays hungry when he tries to go low carb.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really want to do keto per se and eat a lot of fat.
Okay.
And he's trying to walk more. Most days he gets a little bit of walking in.
And what's his height and weight?
His height, he's 5'8", he's 243 pounds. That gives him a body mass index of 37.
And does he have any muscular?
Yeah, he's not very muscular, but he does have an elevated waist circumference.
Waist circumference is
elevated. It's 112 centimeters. All his right, blood so pressure, by the way, is 140 over 90.
So he was referred to the endocrinologist?
Well, I'm kind of saying this is your patient.
Okay.
Because you got him on all that. You got him on the right diabetes stuff, reducing his heart risk and reducing his kidney risk. But now he's got these elevated liver enzymes.
Yeah. Sounds like he's developing maybe some non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. But did he listen to our podcast on that?
Yeah. So, but he's worried about it. And he doesn't drink any alcohol. So he's like, it can't be the alcohol. So we don't want to get too into the weeds, but what would you start looking for? So you already mentioned the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and anybody who knows this probably knows that's the direction we're headed. But
yeah, I mean, he's got high risk features and very high risk for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. I mean, we talked in our podcast, you look at their platelets, you do a FIB4.
Yeah. But you're the primary care doctor. What else would you do? Or what else would you talk to him about? What other things do you need to think about?
Try to get him.
Not that I'm pimping you.
No, I mean, wait. I mean, what are you talking about?
No,
weight
I'm
loss
saying,
or looking at other causes?
Well, for patients out there, they have elevated liver enzymes randomly.
Yeah.
You
look for other causes of the elevated liver enzymes, you know, things like celiac disease. I've found a few, some of his medicines, you want to make sure the medicines aren't causing it.
Right. That's why he asked about medicines.
Yeah. Other things I've seen. Autoimmune.
Those autoimmune mitochondrial and liver diseases. Your doctor will check
ferritin.
You for the different. Yeah. Ferritin. These ferritin. Iron overload things. Obviously, viral hepatitis. You know, hepatitis C, probably everyone's going to get screened for. If there are risks of hep B, would you do that? As a primary care doctor, would you look into all those things?
Yeah, we get the whole panel. I tend to get the whole panel.
Is there a whole panel for?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
you're talking about viral hepatitis.
Yeah, viral hepatitis.
Okay. Panel. Yeah.
Otherwise, you have to, when you're looking for, you know, ruling out other causes, you have to go through the little algorithm and be like, all right, let's get a ferritin. So, yeah.
I want to go backwards a little bit just because I think it might change what we do. So let's say he's not on semaglutide or Ozempic. He's actually on dulaglutide called Trulicity. Yeah. So for those of you out there, those are two different ones. You probably see him on TV. Although you'd be amazed how many people I have who don't say they don't watch TV when I ask them that question.
That's a lie.
It seems pretty legit. So anyway, so let's say that. All right. So your primary care, obviously, everyone's going to have a different physician who feels, different levels of comfort doing different things. But just for discussion's sake, Dr. Spencer's your family practice doctor. He might feel a little bit more comfortable doing some more advanced, you know, endocrine metabolic stuff. But what do you kind of think that the patient should expect from their primary care doctor now? Got a bunch of liver-specific things. They're normal. He doesn't drink alcohol.
I think they should. You could start looking into the elastography and really looking at fibrosis on their liver.
So people really should listen to our fatty liver talk. That goes over a lot of this. So like you mentioned, he's really high risk for not only all those other things like heart disease. He obviously already has diabetes. We're trying to protect his kidneys, but he really is at risk of the liver centric. Like the liver disease that comes from obesity metabolic syndrome, which is called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So it's really become a leading cause of liver failure, cirrhosis, and even cancer, liver cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen, I have a patient, I think I posted about it, but a patient came to me a few years ago. I saw this exact type of thing and I ended up getting them to the liver doctor.
Oh yeah. I remember.
And they've lost now, God, like the 30%, 30 or so percent of their weight. They're not taking any medicine doing it. Not that that would be wrong if they were to take medicine, of course. And they were told they need a liver transplant, but they're holding off because they've lost so much weight and they seem to be stable. So in this patient, I mean, you can do the elastography, see if there's,
Well, you mentioned something called a FIB4. So for the patients out there, we'll, for the sake of argument, say this guy did get what's called a complete blood count, and that includes platelets. And low platelets are a surrogate or can reflect the liver not working so
well.
How well the
liver's working.
Yeah. There's this index that physicians should be calculating that is a good job at estimating your risk of significant liver disease from a fatty liver. And this thing's called a FIB4. It stands for fibrosis 4. And it has to use age and use those enzymes that we talked about, that AST and ALT, and along with this thing called the platelet count. And it just is a risk estimation, just like we do for your heart disease risk or your osteoporosis and fracture risk. We use statistics to use these little calculations that have been validated with a lot of science because we don't want to overdo treatment, right? We don't want to give you medicine if we don't need to. And we want to know how aggressive.
I give everybody Tirzepatide. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah. So, all right. So this guy, anyways, yada, yada, yada. His Fib4 was 1.47. People out there don't care. But what it is it's a kind of an indeterminate or intermediate risk of having significant fibrosis that puts you at a real high risk of liver failure. And so then you mentioned something called an elastography. So it seems like you'd need to send to GI unless, I don't know. I was just talking to people about, man, we should probably get this in our, our obesity and cardiometabolic center, between us and the GI docs, it would get used more.
That would be nice.
So anyways, so this thing that Dr. Spencer is sending you to might not happen unless you see a specialist, like if you ended up being referred to me or the liver doctors. But if we can get more people being aware of this, then maybe this sort of thing will happen. And this is kind of like an ultrasound, but it's called transient elastography. And it really essentially measures the liver stiffness. And so more liver stiffness is really well validated at predicting the risk of fibrosis. And you might not need to go see the gastroenterologist to get a liver biopsy, because that's what this is essentially replacing-ish. But
that's
to get a real diagnosis, you got a liver biopsy.
All right. So did that happen?
Yes. So this guy, he got this thing called a FibroScan, and I don't have any stock in a FibroScan. In fact, maybe I can get my clinic to buy
it. There's different brands, right? There's FibroScan.
Yeah, but that's really the kind of leading one, well-validated one. And it's, his score was 11 kilopascals. And so what that is, and by the way, these FibroScans, they're good for other types of fibrosis, including alcoholic fatty liver disease. Well, this also puts him in this risk for what's called so liver fibrosis gets staged from 0 through 4, and what they call clinically significant, meaning you're at a high risk and we need to do something about it, is from like that F2 through F4. So this puts him in this F2 sort of range, knocking on the door of F3. So he does have high risk. Well, what do you think?
Are they going to biopsy him or no?
No. We're not
going to. No, decided not to. They're just assuming.
No, we don't have a liver doctor around, and he doesn't want to get a biopsy.
All right, so I'm gonna help him lose weight.
Yeah,
that's what I'm gonna do.
So that is the absolute most important and well validated treatment for non-alcoholic fatty liver, and specifically that non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, the inflammatory fibrosis that puts you at the high risk. But we've talked all this time. It's easier said than done. He's on Trulicity, he's on dulaglutide, and he's still just kind of hungry when he goes ketos, cutting the carbs, gets cravings.
Yeah.
So how are you gonna, what kind of dietary plan are you gonna give him? Are we gonna keto?
No.
What about, should we go Ornish, low fat?
No, I'm gonna try to find a way. I'm gonna try to work with him. Probably have to work with one of my coaches to find a dietary pattern that's as satiating as possible with fewer calories. It sounds repetitive and annoying, but like there may be something, and you have to look, culturally, different races, we have different cultures that have different foods. So like, I'm not going to force him into some dietary pattern that he's never going to eat. I remember a Mexican family coming in for CrossFit. And the coach was like, no more corn, and you can't eat corn. It's like, there's nothing wrong with corn. You just probably shouldn't, have super processed whatever, like corn, something or other.
Telling me I'm not allowed to eat ice cream anymore.
Yeah. So,
you know what's interesting? It's going to make this go too long, but and this is the problem with doctors and dietitians who are so extremist and they're just so biased. So we had a few people go to, I hope I don't get in trouble, but a lifestyle medicine clinic. But you know what that means, that they try to force everyone to be vegetarian.
Yeah.
And it really turned off some of my patients. And I'm not knocking vegetarianism. We want people to eat more plants. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But like one of these females was literally like grown up on a beef farm or something like that. And she was like, what? No, I'm not going to do that. And they're like, no, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, why not?
You got to meet people where they
are. Why not make some flank steak, you know, whatever. Yeah, whatever.
Nice, I mean, like, anyways, okay, yeah, so we got to find a way to create an energy deficit.
Lots more plants.
Because his biology is working against
him. Yeah, so his biology is working against him. So we tried our best. He works with one of my awesome coaches, and I'm definitely switching him from dulaglutide to tirzepatide.
But he has coronaries. So this gets into more of a discussion with with my audience at the conference. So what my argument to them was, we don't have the cardiovascular. Yeah, this is going to get too much for patients.
But, I mean, honestly,
but he has established disease.
Yeah,
hasn't tried semaglutide yet. That's why I changed it.
I don't know. I'd go
semaglutide.
I'd go tirzepatide. I'd actually help him lose weight. I'm just kidding. Semaglutide would be fine.
Well, Your Honor.
Semaglutide would be fine, but I'm going tirzepatide, and I'm going to just optimize his lipids obviously he's already on a high dose of rosuvastatin. I'm going to add probably ezetimibe on there too.
Well, we didn't even get into what his 9-HDL was. Anyways, but his triglycerides were high.
We need to make it like 10.
Okay. So what goal weight loss would you kind of like talk to them about that?
Yeah. So he's 240, whatever. Yep. I want to get him to at least lose 25 to 30 pounds at least, if not 40.
So the goal of our weight loss, of course, to treat the obesity, if you know, you start seeing a lot of good liver fat reduction when you get 5-7%, but you really start to reduce that risk of that fibrosis that we're trying to describe. That's that real high risk when you start getting over 10% weight loss. So yes, dietary mechanisms, but we got to help people. And in his case, I think the semaglutide GLP would be good. Now, and there's a reason for that. So semaglutide also and tirzepatide that you talked about, semaglutide specifically has data for people who actually have fibrosis, which he's at risk for. We think he does. And so that's another reason to like maybe think semaglutide. But tirzepatide is almost certainly going to have those cardiovascular benefits. And again, the weight loss is probably the primary reason why semaglutide has done well in these trials for fatty liver and NASH. So we would expect the tirzepatide to also just smoke it. And we already know from one of the studies that it did significantly reduce the liver fat. It was compared to an insulin, Degludec, for some reason.
Yeah.
But it was a cool MRI study. Anyways.
Cool.
So that's that. Yeah. Also, would you want to try to help them do a little bit more Mediterranean pattern, even with the energy reduction?
I'd try, but like, you know, like I said, culturally, whatever.
What if he was drinking butter?
Yeah, we're not doing
butter. Would you want to replace that
butter? We're doing olive oil, nuts,
yeah,
whatever.
Nuts and seeds. So you know, a little bit more Mediterranean pattern, lower saturated fat is probably good for NASH, but not, it doesn't, it kind of means nothing unless we find a way to help them lose the weight. Same, kind of like exercise. Exercise is medicine for fatty liver. But it not necessarily the thing that's going to be the weight loss and reverse the NASH as far as we know. But
yeah, maybe nicely start pumping some iron.
So there are some other medications that he could consider in this case. So I'd be interested to see what you would do as the primary care doctor. So there's a medicine called pioglitazone. The trade name for that was Actos. It really should be generic now. And this medicine has some of the best data in NASH, meaning the actual reducing inflammation and fibrosis. Would you, Spencer, feel comfortable talking to them about Actos, or would you like let someone like me or the
no? I mean,
I don't even know the GI doc would. You might.
I mean, I do it. I do a lot of stuff all the time. If his A1C is high, but I mean, I think you start add on that Terzi, A1C is going to come right down. I promise.
Well, especially with the weight loss, right?
Yeah.
But it would. So this medicine is really good for sugars, and it really works in a fat metabolism sort of mechanism, and it shifts the distribution and where the energy's going. And so it's really good for sugars. It actually does have pretty good cardiovascular safety and benefits. As long as you don't have heart failure for people. So if you have heart failure and feel like you get swollen with fluid too much, you're probably not going to be able to use this medicine. But it is really good for the liver. So that's one. The Jardiance, the empagliflozin he's on, we don't have great data for that fibrosis, that inflammatory part of it, but we know that helps reduce liver fat. Do you think patients will ask about vitamin E? Have you heard that?
Yeah, all the time. They always say fish oil, vitamin E.
Yeah. So now there's not a lot of data for the fish oil part, but the vitamin E has some, but it's not in people with type 2 diabetes. And then there were some concerns. Have patients talked to you much about vitamin E? I really haven't lately.
There were
some cardiovascular concerns, and I think cancer. Is that?
Yeah, that we should have had Kevin.
Kevin Klatt.
when we lost him. Actually, in Deirdre, Dr. Tobias from Harvard has done some tweets on that. We'll have to get her on to talk about the.
So basically, the bottom line with that is, what we put in our guidelines that we talked about in the one of the earlier podcasts, there isn't really enough data to support it, and there's enough concern of risk where it's really kind of fallen out of favor. But there are other medicines coming down the road. But I think you're right that this guy, we just need intensive weight loss efforts. And by the way, other weight loss medications certainly can be considered for depending on other characteristics of patients. So don't think that it's just these meds. But these meds are going to, going to be the preferred ones for someone with
this
that actually has
risk.
NASH because it has the data behind it. So
I wouldn't mess around with other ones. No sympathomimetics in this guy.
All right. So we'll see how people like that, if they ask more questions. Should we do the one more case?
Sure.
Set us up for the future, because a lot of people want us to talk about this. So this is a 26-year-old female. She has concerns about continued weight gain that she's struggling with. She was pretty thin growing up, going through adolescence. She played a lot of sports in high school, but she says she's always had fairly irregular menstrual cycles, and she gets more acne than she thinks is normal. She's always had more hair on her upper lip than she likes and her chin. But now she says she's starting to get some around her belly button. And this is dark hair, by the way. A little bit on her chest even. She says ever since she graduated high school, she slowly gained weight. She gained 20 pounds in college and then a few pounds every year since then. Despite, she's trying to get in the gym. She's working on her diet. She's trying to go keto. But she does struggle with cravings and she gets hungry when she tries not to eat, like when she does like fasting and stuff. She doesn't want to have kids now, but she just got engaged and she'd like to have kids by the time she turns 30, and they're practicing having reproducing.
Yeah. Well, that sounds fun.
Lots of practice.
Nice. I see. sounds like she's got some PCOS, but
what's PCOS? What does that stand for?
Polycystic ovarian syndrome.
So a lot of people have been asking about this, and so this isn't going to be our full podcast on this, but this is just maybe a little teaser.
We want to get one of the best researchers if we can out there to discuss it. We were laughing, well, not laughing, because this Mark Hyman guy. He did a little thing, basically said that, PCOS, it's caused by carbs. It causes bearded lady syndrome or something like that.
Oh,
just
my
very,
God. What a jerk.
Yeah, like he doesn't know what he's talking about. And then he's just blaming it on carbs. It's like,
and then
he
gives Cleveland Clinic a bad name because they decided it was reasonable to have a functional medicine clinic or whatever.
I'd blame them for allowing it. But
So PCOS, I mean, and first of all, this is really not a great name for it. This is just kind of how it was coined because of you get multiple cysts, polycysts in ovaries. And so it's become associated with that. But that's really probably not a huge part of the actual syndrome and the disease process. So, all right. So this person really is seeing you, the primary care doctor. So she says all this stuff. And I mean, what would you tell her from a primary care perspective?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on what her main complaint is. If she's coming in with wanting fertility versus wanting to lose weight or all of the above, I'd help her through any of those, underlying issues, I'd try to help her through the PCOS and address the underlying metabolic abnormalities.
Let's say her BMI is 30, maybe not even, maybe it
looks
29,
let's say
28 and a half.
Not everybody that gains a lot of weight is going to develop PCOS. You have an underlying genetic predisposition, and then the environment kind of interacts with it, with your weight, and then all of a sudden boom.
It sounds like PCOS,
sounds
right?
Like PCOS.
And PCOS is the most common hormone disease in young adult adolescent females. So
yeah.
Statistically makes sense, but you're the primary care doctor. Do you need to check some stuff to make sure it isn't anything else?
Yeah, there's something called the Rotterdam criteria. There's new guidelines.
It's been around forever, though.
The new guidelines have kind of endorsed it.
She meets this criteria because she has two out of the three, the irregular periods,
high androgen levels, just based on the hirsutism.
Androgen then, means like guy, what you kind of stereotypically think of as guy hormones.
Then we didn't do an ultrasound, but
polycystic ovaries, and their criteria for that. But again, that seems to be less of interest these days because it's really everything else going on.
You can confirm these things. You can get a total testosterone.
Right. If they don't have hair, they'll probably need to get drawn. They'll get a testosterone with all their other labs.
Is, I don't know if you probably do this, a 17-hydroxyprogesterone, yep, and some other things to ensure you're not missing something.
There's a few things that we have to check from the hormone world, the endocrine world. So your doctor either will or will ask somebody like me to help and check a prolactin. So that's that hormone that comes from your pituitary, helps with milk letdown. They'll certainly check your thyroid. So they'll check at least a thyroid stimulating hormone because these things, hypothyroidism and too much prolactin, can kind of mimic these features. Not necessarily the weight gain, but the facial hair, the irregular menstrual cycles and all that stuff. You mentioned the 17-hydroxyprogesterone. That's for a relatively rare thing called non-classic adrenal hyperplasia, but that can mimic this. And then there are some rare things. We had a podcast where we talked about hormones and weight, and we talked about Cushing's. So too much cortisol, your stress hormone.
I've had a few patients with PCOS that I swear they had Cushing's because the way the kind of Cushingoid features.
Yeah, I know. So here's another thing. So, a lot of these different, if it's PCOS and it's obesity and, there is kind of it has to do with the cortisol enzyme. So you get more cortisol and less cortisone, which is the 11, innate one. Everyone just fell asleep. Okay.
Whatever. It doesn't matter.
So you got to think about these things.
So we confirmed it's PCOS.
So they were all normal. Yeah. So what else do you got to think about? So, she's got obesity really clinically, right? What if she said my dad has diabetes and he was diagnosed when he was 40? What would you think as a primary care doctor?
Yeah, I mean, she's got insulin resistance.
Yeah, so she's at high risk of developing type 2 diabetes early on. So doctors will do, more blood work again. There's evidence that doing a 2-hour glucose tolerance test is maybe a little bit better in these patients because they tend to show higher this feature of prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. So it's kind of like people often only know about the glucose tolerance test. I call it a sugar tolerance test for when they're pregnant. So that's how we diagnose gestational diabetes, but we do it even if non-pregnancy. And in, this is one of the cases I think we should, I always do. Anyways,
yeah, we joke about CGMs on Twitter, but I've had many PCOS patients come to like, can I have a CGM? And I say, yeah. And you can see clear glucose intolerance there.
So she doesn't want kids yet. We talked about weight loss with the other guy. What would you do for like dietary efforts?
Yeah, one of the most common things people like PCOS screws with your hormones, so you can't lose weight. But I've looked into it multiple times. The metabolic rates tend to be normal, like normalized. Yeah. The total daily energy expenditure seems to be similar to other people. And when you look at different diets and lifestyle changes, there doesn't seem to be a difference with those without PCOS and those with PCOS. Right. So when I've looked into it further, it's probably those with like insulin resistance who have probably appetite derangements. And so, when you get down and start talking to somebody with PCOS who's struggling with their weight, it does. It comes down to sugar cravings
issues. And not only the dietary intervention, but I think we've seen that in some of the medications right? Yeah. Where it's about the same data. Because basically interventional data, it seems to be very similar.
Yeah, higher prevalence of binge eating. And so like what you don't want to do is just say, well, you're eating too much. That doesn't help. It doesn't help
anything. That's not going to help anybody.
They're struggling. It's really tough.
So this is somebody who, I mean, we would certainly talk to about considering medication to help them lose weight.
Yeah, you try your best. You know, I've had patients do just fine. I mean, I get the comments all the time on my social media like, hey, I was able to finally figure out a dietary pattern. They've lost, you know, 5-10% of their weight and have kept it off. They're lifting weights, they're running, all this stuff, and they got a higher protein diet and they're doing fine. But some of the appetite derangement stuff, this is where I love me some GLP-1s in these types of patients. Tirzepatide is my favorite right now, of course, but semaglutide, whatever.
Yeah. I don't think we have any very specific PCOS tirzepatide trials yet, but we have them with like liraglutide.
Yeah, liraglutide.
And semaglutide. So, and the reason weight loss benefits people with PCOS, it's even though it can be in people with low BMIs, we talked about this already, having a low BMI doesn't necessarily make you not have adiposity-based disease. In PCOS, it has a lot of genetics to it, but that just sets up the susceptibility. And so that, you know, having a dysfunctional energy balance going on and having, it's really an adiposity-based disease. And so weight loss, you know, again, that 5-10% goal, more than that, you start improving all these features.
Yeah, I can really change fertility, the communication, which is important, between the ovaries and the pituitary, and all of a sudden things start working. Infertility comes, all of a sudden my patients will be like, I'm pregnant. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing.
And part of that, in fact, probably the biggest part of that is the insulin resistance, which is, it really creates this vicious cycle of, you know, hypothalamic pituitary dysfunction. We talked about, that's where you get your hormones that stimulate your ovaries, but then there's too much of the hormones, and then there's insulin resistance. So then the ovaries making too much androgen. And then it's this vicious cycle. So diet efforts, weight loss, exercise, certainly for that insulin resistance. They also have, like we talked about, the high risk of type 2 diabetes, probably a long-term higher risk of heart disease. So, you know, exercise and
lipids, getting your lipids under control as well. Yeah.
Lipids, we're going to, you know, your doctors will check your sugars and maybe even that Fib-4, especially if there's any AST, ALT elevation.
Just to be careful, though, if you're on a GLP-1 and you do looking at fertility, you want to stop the GLP-1 2 months at least before trying to conceive.
Yeah, although we don't know that there's really any harm with
there
this,
isn't.
Right?
We don't think there is. It's one of these guidelines.
Yeah, it's
for anybody out there, because I've had a few patients get pregnant on these things.
I was going to say a lot of people have gotten pregnant on them, and we haven't seen any harm.
I haven't seen any issues.
Just to be fair,
be careful.
So anyways, but other things that we have to think about, you know, there's increased risk of endometrial cancer. So it is important to regulate your menstrual cycle. And the first line is generally birth control pills, some sort of oral contraceptive pill. Do you do that much as a family doc these days?
I'm an obesity specialist and lipid specialist now, so I'm not doing primary care.
You don't say.
I have like, you know, maybe 100 primary care patients still from my old practice, but
so that's important for the endometrial hyperplasia, which is the growth that, you know, we want to prevent cancer. And it also is the first line therapy, helps to reduce the hair growth that you don't want and the acne and all that stuff too.
Yeah. So symptomatic control, but lifestyle changes. My coaches do great at helping my PCOS patients improve. So
you know, metformin has helped, you know, not a ton of weight loss, but it does kind of help with that insulin resistance part.
The side effects really can piss people off, but if you tolerate it.
Yeah, they piss off all the type 2 diabetes patients too. But
if you can tolerate it,
it doesn't improve that androgenism, that male hormone stuff, the acne and the hair. So we might prescribe something called spironolactone, which I think we've talked about that medicine before. It blocks your blood pressure hormone that comes from your adrenal glands, but it also blocks like testosterone type hormones like androgen. So do you ever talk to patients about that? Or you
I have a lot of patients on spironolactone.
Okay, good. So that's another thing your doctor might talk to you about. And then there's some topical therapies, and probably would you talk to them about the fertility stuff? Like if she said, hey, you know what? I want to get pregnant right now. Would you talk to her about, not that patients really care the names of these things, but the letrozole and clomiphene, or would you just kind of get them to reproductive endocrinology?
I'd go to reproductive endocrinology. Yeah. I wouldn't mess with that.
So we're probably a little bit more on the fence. I mean, we might do that. OBGYN might do it, but certainly reproductive endocrinology, they're the ones that are going to be the ones to
We should get my reproductive endocrinologist friend on.
Let's do it.
She'll come on.
What's her name? Give her a shout out. So she'll listen to this. And
she's coming. We're getting her on. Actually, I should just text her right now. She's on. She's actually pregnant herself.
Oh, perfect. Hurry.
Let's see.
Okay. Well.
All right, Doctor. I mean, Doctor Hawkins.
Anyway, I mean, that's kind of the basics of what I think. You know, so for this girl, she doesn't want to have kids right now. So you talk to her about a birth control pill, probably.
Yeah.
Because then you want to give her some terzepatide rather than metformin.
A little terzepatide.
Okay. See if she wants to do that. If we could get it. I mean, obviously that's a whole different thing.
Lifting weights, running, dietary patterns.
And that's for health, most importantly. And give her a weight loss medicine in her case. And then someday we can make sure by the way, that's like we said before, that will improve her future fertility. Obviously we got to work really hard on weight maintenance. Cause like you said, she won't be on those medicines, when she tries to get pregnant. And so then, you know, a lot of effort for weight maintenance, easier said than done.
Yeah. Easier said than done. And you know, some of these habits with, lifestyle changes, they might be able to stick to it long term. It's hard to know. You never know with each person. So
absolutely, but, exercise really important. Exercise is medicine. So stay tuned. We'll do a lot more on PCOS. That's been a high request.
Yeah, we need to get some experts. And then Dr. Hockman, my friend, she might be able to just go over fertility in general.
Because
a lot of people struggle with fertility, not from PCOS, but also with their weight, and weight can actually improve their fertility. So. Weight loss.
And Abby Ramsier, I think she was the first one that said, hey, you know what? She's an OBGYN friend of mine. And she was like, yeah, let's do a whole women's series. And heck yeah.
Very good. Awesome. Yeah, we don't need two meathead guys.
Telling all the girls what's going stuff. On.
All right. Very good. All right. Well, there's our two cases, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and PCOS, two important things that we see often in the clinic or in the cloud. If you struggle with these, just know there's specialists out there that can help you. And don't let your doctor just say, oh, your liver enzymes are elevated, whatever, just lose some weight. You do have to go through the pathway and look for things. And if you're told you had PCOS with your irregular periods, you probably need some further workup to confirm just to be sure. So hopefully if you listen to this, you got some good ideas if you're a patient or if you're a fellow clinician looking to help people that struggle with these. So anyway, give us a 5-star review. Go tell your friends about us.
Please.
Please. All right. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.